Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel. It is Tuesday, the 24th of June, and great to have you with us as always. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll get to the mailbag in just a moment. Well,
assuming
as you start writing and we fill the mailbag.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I realize in the email world there isn't a bag, actually, but you know what I mean. A mailbox.
There's a mailbox.
There is a mailbox.
A virtual bag.
And you can fill it up. You
yes,
know,
you can.
Because if your limit is low, that's it.
That's right.
Right.
The voice you just heard is that of Libby Post, our political consultant, who is back after a few days. And it's wonderful to have her back. So thank you very much for being here. We missed you.
I missed you guys, too.
Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain has been here since you left. But we missed him, too. So he's... he's back as well. And WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Always great to see your smiling face.
Well, thank you. I'm beaming from ear to ear. And it is. We have a lot of good stuff to talk about. Interesting stories to go over. So let us begin that. And I guess we start, of course, with Iraq, as we have for the last several days and even over a week now. Dissatisfaction with President Obama's conduct of foreign policy has shot up among both Republicans and Democrats in the past month, even though a slim majority supports his recent decision to send military advisors to Iraq. This, according to a New York Times CBS News poll, we suggested we read, I think, the preliminary numbers on this yesterday. Survey suggests that most Americans back some Mr. Obama's approaches to the crisis in Iraq, including majority support for the possibility of drone strikes. But the poll documents an increasing lack of faith in the president and his leadership and shows deep concern that further intervention by the United States in Iraq could lead to another long and costly involvement there. I guess the key line for me was an increasing lack of faith in the president and his leadership.
That would be key line pie. I said yesterday, and I'm sticking with it, no matter what, that, look, things are bad. When things are bad and the president doesn't make them better, people are going to be unhappy with him. Look, they're going to blame him for the fact that it's on his watch. It doesn't matter who started it. It's on his watch, and therefore I happen to have great admiration for the guy personally, but I'm not the whole poll. Because I just simply think his refusal to go marching in, guns blazing, doesn't make any sense. Who invited us? Do they want us? We've just lost all of these people. We spent $1 trillion or whatever it is. It's crazy. So now Kerry goes to Iraq, and what does he do there? He announces that if these guys don't come around, then military options are not out. Now, we have a president who is saying, look, I don't want to go in there. At the same time, you have Kerry say, whoops, we gave away the store by saying we're not going in. Just kidding. We may go in. And that, of course, looks even weaker because now you have the Secretary of State, I think, undercutting what the president has been saying. I'm sure the White House agrees with this. But you did what? You said we're not going in. Now they'll do anything they want. So now we have to say military options are still on the table.
I think part of it is, I agree with you, you know, this is really a no-win situation all around. So it's no matter what we do. But I think part of it is that And this comes through time and time again with Obama, and I too love him, and I think he's a great president. But he's not a rah-rah kind of guy. He doesn't know how to rally the troops around the flag. He's not out there enough, you know, touching the people and really listening, but making that personal contact, even if it's just on the television, which, you know,
Ronald
some
Reagan.
Of these presidents have been masterful
Reagan.
In doing.
Right.
He doesn't do that. And I think that, you know, rather than squander the next 2.5 years, because he has some opportunities to do things, you know, there needs to be a reset button here for him so that he can go out there and be more of a populist in a more responsible way.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, but it is a president at the end of his second term, you know, halfway through his second term. And people, what does the poll say, Joe? Was it 58% of Americans disapprove the way Mr. Obama is handling foreign policy? And that's an increase of 10%. And even a third of Democrats are saying they're unhappy. What is it that they would have done differently?
Right. Whether it's that.
They don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Right. That's right. You're right, Alan. They can just say, I'm unhappy with the way the foreign policy is, therefore I'm unhappy with his leadership.
Yeah. But
it's his fault.
Can I just throw this out, and maybe this is, I don't know. But we said this about President George W. Bush. We're upset. Different people, but they were upset.
Mm-hmm.
Plummet. Numbers are low. Things are down. This president comes in. Numbers plummet. Things are low. I mean, is there going to be somebody who is going to have what you talked about, Libby? Or are we living in a culture where we're not going to give people that shot?
It's a personality-driven thing, and I don't know if he can take the shot, if it would work. I think ultimately we want to see our leaders and we want to believe in our leaders. So I think if he did give that shot, that people would give him the opportunity to take the shot. This, and again, you know, no matter what you do, and you're right, you know, I'm not making these decisions. My kids aren't going to go to war, you know, and it's not going to be our kids going to war if we do go to war, you know. And so, you know, can he turn this around from a PR point of view? That's up in the air. Will those numbers ever bounce back? All of us can sit here armchair quarterbacking all day long. We don't have to sit in that chair and make these decisions.
Mm. Who do you think the Republican frontrunner is for 2016?
I don't think they have one.
Yeah. Do they have one? I mean,
I agree with that.
I guess so. My question is, if you see Hillary Clinton or even, I don't know, Joe Biden or a Republican to be named later, do you see anyone with that ability to not be in this same position, I guess?
I have to tell you, I think Joe Biden has the ability to reach out and touch the public.
He's a great campaigner.
He's a great retail
politician.
Very
personable. Right.
He's a nice guy.
The press seems to hate him.
Yeah, they do.
Because he gets sort of a goofy image, right?
Well, they're giving him that. I don't have to believe it.
No, I agree with you.
But this morning, one of the tabs, probably the evil one, had a not that they don't both have some of those qualities.
Less expensive, but consider the source, said
Biden puts his foot in his mouth again.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff.
I read the article.
I didn't think he put
I mean, he was talking about his own wealth and his own pension. Is this the story?
Yeah. Yeah. He said he didn't have a lot of money. He said he's vice president of the United States. He doesn't have anything in his savings account.
He was following up on
Hillary.
But he has a good pension, he says.
Yeah, sure.
And Hillary makes more in one speech than he makes all year.
Yeah.
Well, and that's true.
Well,
right.
And the reason and everybody
true.
Likes him is because he tells the truth.
Right.
Well, when he was senator, he was still taking the train back and forth.
I mean,
there was that sort of...
I mean, he's very dedicated to his family. The whole family dynamic with him, what happened to him, the death, the kids, all of that stuff, has really made him... Joe regular.
But it's interesting because Hillary's beginning to take her lumps.
Yeah.
Now there's the imperial Hillary, which is being raised by everybody else and all the rest. So that's when a guy like Biden becomes, you know, a little bit more attractive.
Yeah. But I'm just wondering, are we going to come up with anybody who fits, who's able to take this kind of situation? Or have we created a culture and an environment that is so toxic and anti anything that they're going to face this from one side or the other?
I really think that is the question. If Ronald Reagan were alive today and in his prime and president, would he be able to handle things better?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, rhetorically. I think that he would.
Clinton.
Look at Clinton. I mean, I agree. I think that there is this sort of hostility that has grown. I mean, if you look at the polls, there's a whole bunch of people in the middle who are just like they always have been. They don't pay that much attention. They're up and down about things. But the polarization is at both the right and left.
Mm.
And it becomes unworkable. I mean, the idea of political parties kind of coming together in common ground, There was, Pat Moynihan once was asked something like, over some tax issue. They had a clip of it on TV a couple of nights ago, back when he was, you know, a powerful U.S. senator. And they said, well, would you die for this one? He goes, over taxes? Heck no. Over women, maybe. Or, you know, over country, yes, but not over taxes. You know, we'll come to some compromise, you know. And that kind of attitude isn't there today. You know, that humor, that collegiality that's necessary for compromise just doesn't
exist. On the other hand,
exist.
Go back to Thomas Jefferson, see what they were saying about him. You know, I mean, our politics have often been extremely
cycles.
Mean.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and, you know, that's part of the sports mentality of, you know, winners and losers and good guys and bad guys.
But when you're talking about war,
yeah,
and I realize that this is a relatively new rule of thumb, but the rule of thumb always was that wag the dog theory, that once you started to mobilize the troops, that the American people were going to follow you, and that has ceased.
Well, there was
we don't know yet.
But there was also the notion that the party not in power didn't question the foreign policy decisions. I mean, they did with Vietnam after a while.
Yeah.
Right. But there was never this playing out of our foreign policy decisions in the media like there is now.
And by the way, well, I'm not suggesting that's the good old days or the golden standard that we should go back to.
One of the reasons it took so long to get involved in the Second World War is because Roosevelt had to very carefully lead the country into the war.
We didn't want it.
And the isolationists, I mean, it's hard to remember how powerful they were. They were huge. And he knew that, you know, he could lose his presidency and everything else if he didn't do it right. And that's where he really was masterful.
Well, there was a quote in the New York Times story, Joe, that you had just been referring to that says, about the poll on Obama, "I voted for him because he said, give me 4 more years and I will fix everything. But nothing is fixed." This is Michelle Roberts, a Democrat from Salem, Massachusetts. "I understand he wants to fight terrorism, but send in robots and drones. Don't send in troops. Our men and women are dying. For what?" You know, and that does sum it up. People, they don't want things to happen in Iraq the way that they're happening. They want it to stop. They don't. Absolutely, nobody wants troops on the ground. They don't want any more soldiers coming back maimed or coming back dead. But they have this illusion that we can sit in an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean and run some sort of robotic war, and that will make a big difference. But,
I think picking up on something Libby said about the reset button, it seems like the reset button, most people assumed it would be reset after the reelection.
I'm not following.
Was saying that at this point, they have to set a reset button and the Obama administration sort of take on these issues head on and be more of a leader. But I think a lot of people probably thought that reset button was going to happen just as your comment indicated that it was going to happen 2 years ago.
I don't know what they – I mean, we've said it for 3 days now. I don't know what the answer is here.
There is no answer.
I mean, one of the problems is that if you do what Mike just said people want with drones and, you know...
It'll pull you in.
It will, and what'll happen is you'll start killing civilians and people will say... To me, the big issue is, what is the rationale for our going in? In other words, do we really want... Look, we all know what this is. We have interests over there. Do we really want this group of whatever, terrorists, if whatever you want to call them... do we really want them running this stateless state and being able to control the oil and control the wealth and to that's what the real politic about this is about. It isn't about the fact that they don't want us there. They don't want us there. It isn't the fact that, you know, we're going in somewhere and we're going to be able to do anything really without boots on the ground, because we can't. And so the American people are wise to that, but there are other interests other than polls that are at stake here. And when that has happened in the past, as you said before, was it Libby or Mike? We get led into this.
I'll take credit.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I said, well, I'll take credit.
Yeah, we get led into it, and it happens. And then we say, you know, it's awful.
There's an article in the New York Times today about the president of Iraq and sitting down with Kerry and saying that we are facing a new reality in a new Iraq, and and sort of that idea that, okay, that they don't know what that's going to be, we don't know what that's going to be, and as you said, there is really, Libby, that there is, we don't know what to do, nobody knows what to do, because we don't know what that new is. But it does seem like there is some opportunity to at least have a hand in the creation of that.
Well, that's what we thought in Afghanistan in 1980.
Right.
And look how well that worked out for us. You know, so I think we do know what's going to happen here. I think if you take 10 steps forward and look 10 steps backwards, I think we do know we're going to have an Islamic State. It might be as big as Syria and Iraq. I think you're going to have the pressure on the oil, and that will be the motivating factor for us to get in. But we're going to have another Islamic State in the middle of the Middle East, and that's where things are going.
Now you're
and
forgetting, of course, about our quote partners. The good people,
yeah,
like,
but
the other Islamic
the, yeah,
right,
the good people,
sure,
like the Saudis who cut people's heads off,
right,
because they married,
I mean,
the wrong
that's
person.
The thing, you know, we're, you know, in bed with
just hands,
yeah, yeah, no, but his head,
heads and hands,
yeah, you know, so right, and what are they really going to do?
So you can't hold it,
and they can't drive a car,
right. But whose side are they really going to come down on? The infidel Americans?
No, they are not,
or the Islamic militants? I mean, you know, it's really. We're in this for, we're going to be in this for the long haul, no matter whether we go in tomorrow, we go in next week.
Let me throw
we
out
have
up.
No, we don't, there's no rational way of looking at this and dealing with this for to have a positive outcome that we can say this is what's going to happen.
In our 2 minutes before break, let me throw out a huge open-ended question,
a
huge what-if question, but just to wonder. If we had taken more decisive, not that what we didn't do was, I'm not saying that, but if we had done the strikes in Syria, like we were talking about, if we had taken more definitive action, military action in Syria.
It would have crippled this ISIS movement, perhaps. You know, that's what some people are saying. They're
right.
Looking back. I mean, you know, it's just like everything else.
Well, as you say, it's armchair
wait
quarterbacking.
A second.
I realize that.
Second.
If we had taken that
definitive action and helped, you know, the guys who were the quote, you know, rebels. And it turned out that the rebels, as in Afghanistan, were people who could destroy us or wanted to destroy us. You know, this what if game doesn't really work for me.
Meaning that that we would be in the situation we are now, probably it just would have been 6 months sooner.
Or regardless. It would have been different. It would have been different, but bad.
Still bad.
Yeah.
And still scratching our heads saying, what's the right thing to do?
Yeah. I mean, when we were supporting those the rebels, and I said to myself, are we sure we know what we're doing this time?
They'll take our money and then...
And then send some 9/11
right,
people over.
Right, yeah.
We're going to take a break. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, and Mike Spain making up the panel this morning. We welcome your comments as always. Again, roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. And we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org, which is where we collect letters like this one.
Okay, like Tom. And what does Tom have to say? No offense to you guys.
Thank you.
But I don't want a rah-rah president who's going to get us into a conflict we shouldn't be in. Did anybody here say we want him to be a rah-rah president? Sometimes I wonder whether people, you know, make the stuff up and project what they're
we
thinking.
We did note that he's subtle and low-key.
No, I just
want
him to be
some
out
enthusiasm
there with the people
in whatever
more, that's all.
Right, okay,
yeah.
All right, there's that.
But I don't want rah-rah, let's go to war.
Yeah, okay. And then, is that it? Did you see anything else, Joe?
There was one.
Oh, yeah, here's one from Cheryl. Dear Roundtable, excellent program. You discussed President Obama's lack of hands-on who without recognition of the continuing virulent underground racism that serves to handicap him at every term. I believe the GOP and Tea Party succeeded in backing him into a corner. Let me his PR options. Thank you, Cheryl.
All right. And then scroll up and you should find two more.
I should, but I... Oh, yeah, here's one from our usual correspondent, Walker, who says, we might be over-polling and underthinking this stuff. The more polling we hear about from, what, a dozen outfits, the less accurate the numbers seem to be in terms of what people really think. People pick up the phone and are asked to quickly choose among four or five very broad responses. People respond according to their emotional state at the time. The questions are asked, and often none of the choices reflect what we think. Then we hear the results up the wazoo. Which part of the body is that? And never know what the questions were that people were asked.
Tracheal pipe.
Then we talk about the numbers ad nauseum until the next poll comes out. And then John, our old friend John, what should we do? Three question marks. Haven't we done enough already? Bush's policies, parentheses, backed up by too many Democrats, destabilized the region. The combatants on all sides are using the weapons we sent there. We've literally wasted up to $2 trillion and we needed and still need so badly here. Our military is broken. Our youth are more disillusioned than ever. How about doing nothing? I know that's a concept that's hard for Americans to get their hands on. But just because we have power doesn't mean it has to be used, especially discriminately. Sometimes you have to wait until the game comes to you. This is one of those times. If we haven't learned by now, it'll probably serve as our epitaph sooner or later. And that's from our old friend John. And then Elizabeth says, Eisenhower created the highways across the width of the entire nation. Why not immediately build soft solar wind lining the same and tell Iraq to keep its oil? In other words, we would not have interest there. Plus, they don't want us in big capital letters. Oh, they don't want us. It's a quagmire that we should not solve or win. Sincerely, Liz. And then JR says, good morning, table. Isn't one of the most important lessons that earlier from earlier Iraq inventions that we must have a goal, a well-defined objective for any intervention or our involvement almost by definition must be for an indefinite period. And how well-defined can a goal be against an amorphous enemy like these terrorist combatants? And then Scott complains that he tried to vote in his primary, but the polling place was not open until noon.
That's usually what it is on a primary day.
Some are not open until
Okay. And that's what I got. Did you find anything else, Joe?
I got it. I have what you have.
Okay.
Well, it seems that an anecdotal survey like this of your audience, as
the audience
is that they are against further U.S. intervention in Iraq firmly.
But I think it also shows that as the poll suggests, that while some people were mocking or not, batting the poll, knocking down the poll, it does seem like there is still that idea of what the poll indicates is that we're all over the place. We're mixed. We don't know what to do.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC, .org. Story I meant to get to yesterday and we didn't have time, so we'll get into it today because Alan mentioned it earlier about this idea of Hillary Clinton and the imperial image. Interesting Washington Post article that's been making the rounds. When Hillary Rodham Clinton said this month that she was once dead broke, it was during an interview in which she led ABC News anchor Diane Sawyer through her $5 million Washington home, appointed like an ambassador's mansion. Mahogany antiques, vibrant paintings, and oriental rugs fill the room. French doors open onto an expertly manicured garden and a turquoise swimming pool where Clinton recently posed for the cover of People magazine. So such scenes reveal a potentially serious political problem for Clinton as she considers a 2016 presidential run. She and her husband are established members of the 1%, living lives far removed from the millions of middle-class voters who swing elections. Clinton has underscored the contrast with a series of stumbles in discussing her finances, the latest in an interview with Britain's Guardian newspaper, published Sunday, in which she compared herself with other multimillionaires. Unlike the truly well-off, Clinton said, she and former President Bill Clinton pay ordinary income tax and have amassed their fortune through dint of hard work. So this idea of imperial image, what do you make of it? Because it seems to be a phrase that's sticking.
Well, in, you know, there is a certain lack of, as Libby and Mike said before, of contact with the people. On the other hand, she's beating the hell out of everybody in all of the polls, and she doesn't want to blow it. Now, we can go back no further than to Barack Obama coming on, and all of a sudden people said, you know, here's a people's alternative to the sort of imperial, you know, group who, you know, who really don't touch us. And everybody projected into Barack Obama whatever they wanted to think about what they wanted. And so here's this guy, and they say, okay, he's a human being, and he's our human being, and he's going to go out there, and he's going to stop all wars forever, and he's going to stop, you know, the oil stuff, and he's going to do the right stuff. And it turns out that he was a human being, all right. And that he had his limitations, like everybody has their limitations. So, long-winded, is it necessary to have an imperial, you can't touch me type of person to be the president of the United States? Are you following? In other words, do you need somebody who has that sort of sense of, I've been through it all,
a woman
I've
of the
seen
people.
It all? No. No,
well, not the opposite of that.
Not, yeah, the opposite. Not a woman. I'm sorry.
A woman not of the people.
A woman who says she's of the people, but who, like the great presidents of the United States, George Washington and Dwight Eisenhower,
so,
keep their hands out and say, okay, you can go this far, but don't try to get more intimate with me.
Now, let me just throw this out as an anecdote, because when she was the junior senator in this state, the Empire State of New York.
Indeed.
And her aspirations, political aspirations, were clear at that point, of course. And I remember we were doing reporting and talking to people, a guy who was a dairy rep going to farm supply stores. And he said, the interesting thing is that I go to stores in all 64 counties in this state, and every store I walk into, there's a picture of Hillary Clinton with her shaking the hand of the owner. She's
That's
been to
great.
Every county. She's been to every town. She's been to every county fair. I bring that up only because if this is the image, don't you think this is what she's going to be fighting over the next year if she indeed does decide to be president? With that in mind, we'll do everything in her power to reverse that.
Well, look, for those of us who've interviewed her over the years, when she was senator, I did a couple of times. And I have to tell you, she's incredibly talented.
Yeah,
she can take your measure as an interviewer, and she can twist you right around her finger. So she knows how to do it when she has to do it, and the fact that she goes to each of these places and that they do it by the book is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that she just has to keep a certain plasticity around her, so that she doesn't get dragged into bad decisions, like this business about, you know, which everybody's quoting. I don't find it so horrible, but others do, about the money. You know, we were broke.
I don't know if it's horrible, but it does seem dumb.
It does. It was the wrong thing to say.
I mean,
say.
It just seems like they've been in a political machine for the last 30 years.
Yeah. But
you would think they would know better
but
than
yeah,
that.
But you know what? I think she thinks that being truthful is disarming. And from her perspective, she was being truthful.
Mm-hmm.
She was saying, okay, you know, parenthesis, we have all of this stuff. But we were broke.
Broke's a relative term.
No, I'm not going to argue that with you, Mike. I'm just simply saying that she was telling you we were broke during that time.
Jimmy Carter said the same thing.
Yep.
And
lust in his heart.
No, he said the same thing that he was broke coming out of the White House. They had tremendous debt. It worked for him because what happened is they found out that indeed.
He was broke.
Yeah. He had a lot of debt. They had a lifestyle that they had to keep up as a former president. And it was difficult for them until they started to, you know, figure things out. Right. Absolutely.
Well, you know, people can go around and they can, you know, Donald Trump can go broke. He can go bankrupt.
He did.
Yeah.
And he always bounces back.
And with other people's money, whatever it happens. It depends on your perspective. If you happen to be the guy, the Schmegeggy, who is, you know, who is living in, you know, in near poverty, which so many people in this country now are, more and more and more, and somebody says we were broke. And meant we couldn't keep buying houses, or we couldn't pay our legal fees, or whatever. You got to be aware.
But they are hurtful, these comments that I was broke. Yes. I mean, it was like when John McCain couldn't remember exactly how many houses he had.
Right.
I remember, you know, it just and then all the hoopla about the house that.
But they always get you, Bush going. It was a Pataki or Bush going through the
no,
line with the milk.
Oh, I didn't know that they.
Oh, that was George Walker Bush.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he had a scanner.
You know, really
wow, that's
a lot
pretty
of
cool.
He'd
been around
right,
for 10
yeah,
years.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is that what's changed between now and 1992,
yeah.
when he first ran, is social media. And there's no controlling the message anymore like we used to be able to. And so people are going to take this and run with it. And the people who hate her are just going to hate her more.
Yes, but on the one hand, we started this with the imperial person who doesn't let anything get to her. As soon as she starts to talk, talkless, as Cuomo used to say, and get down to basics and say, I'm a human being and I want to tell you everything about myself, everybody says, oh, gotcha. So you have the choice. The imperial with a plastic patina, or do you have the honest person who is, say, okay, you know, let me tell you what this is about.
But shouldn't the question be, what can you do in Iraq right now? What would you do? What would you do with Egypt right now? What would you do in the Ukraine right now?
You're not going to see her saying a lot about it because it's broken right now, and she wants to be the president. And why should she take? And I think, by the way, that's why she's not Secretary of State anymore.
And steal that thunder.
My point being that it would be talking about the issues as opposed to her pocketbook.
Well, no. I mean, I think it was an incidental question. And it's the incidental questions which Sarah Palin, always get you.
Right. Like, what magazine do you read? I'm sure Hillary can answer that. I think this whole thing is just, you know, another opportunity for the Karl Roves of the world to do some direct mail and stir up their base. And when it comes down to it in 2016, it's not going to be the imperial image. It's going to be how we're going to get people out of poverty, how we're going to fix the country.
I've also heard this.
And who she's compared to.
Right.
And I've also heard this, and even maybe some people in her camp of saying that it's a sexist remark. And
wouldn't say it about a guy who made millions.
Afterwards. Well, didn't we just say that about George W. Bush, though? Yeah. I mean, sort of not knowing the.
But he came with millions.
Well, that's true.
He came with millions, and he was totally out of touch. He's old Connecticut money.
And by the way, people love him now. You know, he's
jumped out of the plane.
I know. That was amazing.
Yeah. Looked great.
And compared to the other one, he does look awful good.
You mean his son, the other one?
Yes.
The other president.
Right, the other president.
I'll bet his popularity will go up.
Let's take a break. We'll be back and talk about other issues. We welcome your letters. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC gives them Safe Harbors of the Hudson, Newburgh, presenting Lucy Illuminated, an original play about Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, and part of the Newburgh Illuminated celebration in the lobby at the Ritz through June 29th, safeharborsofthehudson.org. Let It Grow Nursery, Cherry Valley, New York, offering perennials, trees, and shrubs, open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. through October, 607-264-3247. And Hudson Valley Foot Associates, podiatric physicians and surgeons treating foot problems with offices in Ulster, Dutchess, Columbia, Orange, and Delaware counties. HVFA.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We have a few minutes left. We'll start off with a letter or two, and then we'll finish up on a couple topics. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay. So Tim says, Putin wanted to keep Syria together under Assad. America turned Assad into a monster, as we did Saddam Hussein before that. But are Mideast strongmen the only hope of keeping the countries ecumenical and from becoming a magnet for jihadists? Putin doesn't want an Islamist state to his south in Iraq, Syria. What will he do? The Kurds need to restrain ISIS as well. What will Turkey do as well? Are we forgetting Sunni versus Shia dynamics in this discussion? Tim from Woodstock.
Very That's what I got. Questions.
All right. We welcome your letters and your questions. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Take just a moment because it's an article that is in the Times Union, and sad news that the passing of a broadcast colleague, Judy Sanders, who was a longtime presence on WRGB and who passed away yesterday after a long battle with cancer. I think just 2 or 3 weeks ago, Paul Grondahl did a beautiful piece mm-hmm. where he went over and spoke to her in the Berkshires. As they knew it was her time was ending, and it's I think we've all had our moments with Judy. Mine have only been we're only pleasant and lovely, and I know that
great sense of humor, very serious though. You know, about her business.
Well, let me just say that I worked with her for a long time.
Long time at RGB.
Yeah. And that she had a beacon, a lamp that led the way for so many other women in the profession. And that I was at press conferences with her. And if anybody got in her way, boy, you know, she took their heads off. And whatever the language was, it was, it was the language. So nobody's going to push her around because she was a woman. And she was bright and knew what she was doing. And you didn't want to get into a fight with her.
No, I dealt with her as a flack, you know.
Yeah, you were the flack.
I was the flack. I was the PR person. And, you know, she was tough, you know, but fair. And, and she was. She really did lead the way. I mean, I was down in the LCA at the Legislative Correspondents Association in the 80s, and, you know, it was really a big boys' club, and she was there doing her thing with a few other women. And now you look down there, and it's a lot of women.
Mostly women, yeah.
It's mostly women. It's a lot of women doing their thing, leading the way, continuing what Judy did. And she was a trailblazer and a great example of what women can do in journalism, and she'll be missed.
And, you know, after she did that, she left the RGB.
Right.
And she went over to be the governor's photographer.
For three governors.
For three different governors.
Right, yeah.
And she apparently did it extremely well.
Well, she's a beautiful photographer.
Right.
Her work was gorgeous.
Yeah, she went to Skidmore College and studied photography and then went on to Pratt Institute. And, you know, she had received many prizes and many awards over the years. She won an Emmy. But more recently, she was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Women's Press Club of New York. And that was just earlier this month.
Yeah,
and she came to the event a few weeks ago and spoke very softly. And it was just a very emotional event, according to everybody who was present at that event.
Mm-hmm.
A really gracious woman.
If you get a chance to read Paul's piece, I assume you have it on...
Uh-huh. Oh,
a link on the page. It's a very, very nice piece. We wanted to mention that. Also, let us talk about one other. I guess the other story in the 3 minutes that we have left, Mike, is quickly about Naira and some of what this is going to mean for the Saratoga Racecourse.
It's only a month away, and the thoroughbred racetrack racecourse season will begin at Saratoga. But this year, Naira is trying to climb out of...
Naira being the New York Racing Association.
Yes, the New York Racing Association,
for those of you who live in
operates the racecourse under contract with New York.
They're
trying to climb out of running deficits, and they want to operate on their own in the black, and they are going to try to offset some of their costs by raising the daily admission from $3 up to $5. That clubhouse admission will go up from $5 to $8. But
people won't come because it's $2 more?
No, I don't. I think they are betting that they will not stay away, even if it's a couple dollars more. There's going to be season passes that you can get with an ID card, so you can go every day, and those are pretty affordable, so people will be encouraged to come. They're also going to have a lot of events going on. They're going to showcase New York wines and New York foods on different days, and there's going to be big flat-screen TVs to replace the smaller screens that are hanging from the trees in the backstretch, so people can have parties all over the place.
You go to the races, do you, Mike?
Very rarely.
Joe, you go, don't you?
I don't go as much as I did.
Yeah.
After my father died, I haven't been too much.
Interesting.
Yeah, I like to go and watch people. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Channel 6 used to dress me up because I always took the negative why we shouldn't have racing. So they used to put me in spats and a top head hat. And, you know, and
you were a swell,
and a morning coat. And I would go and I would trash him. And then I heard from that. I don't mention the name, but I heard from that lady who said, "Who is that terrible guy?" So, you know, the lady. So,
Mrs. VW.
Did I say not to say anything? Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Were you mocking that lifestyle?
All right. Just so you know, you didn't ask me, but I never go.
Yeah. Why didn't I ask you? You think that was sexist?
I don't.
No.
I think you just passed right
No, because you believe she has an imperial image.
Right.
No, because I think she's a very sensible woman.
I never go. I think it's boring, actually, to be quite honest.
I don't like the fact that they're exploiting the horses.
My dad took us to Belmont in the mornings to watch them train, and I thought that was great. But to go, and it's just too much. It's like... Who cares?
But this is a huge event in our region that brings
There's other things to do.
Well, they'll have giveaways again.
Right. I have a friend who wants to
a red
giveaway.
Baseball cap.
How about a joke?
Your glasses. A tote bag.
It's a horrible, disgusting event.
They'll give you a hat.
Every time she goes and spins and spins and spins to get the giveaways.
Yeah.
Didn't Joe Burnham have a bobblehead, or am I wrong about that?
No, I think there was a bobblehead. Well, that might
not from the track.
I think that was
over at the
maybe Tom Durkin will have a bobblehead this year.
Well,
the
one thing is that he's retiring, and that voice has been.
He's Tom Durkin being the announcer.
The announcer calls the races. We're out of time, everyone.
Okay,
but thank you very much.
You are so welcome.